This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is off this week. Coming up, how Walmart became fantastically wealthy while keeping its workforce in poverty. And Herman Wallace of the Angola 3 tastes 2 days of freedom before dying. But first, President Obama is intent on ramming through Congress his Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Bill. But some Democrats are balking, saying they won't be rubber stamps for the treaty, which is backed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other corporate groups. We asked Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance, what does any of this have to do with people struggling for survival in places like Detroit?
It had a lot to do with people in Detroit. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is essentially an outgrowth of NAFTA. It's a bigger, badder NAFTA. And a lot of Detroit and the Midwest problems really stem from NAFTA, where we lost 600,000 jobs because of a trade agreement that sent lousy jobs out of the country and didn't enrich the people in Mexico, but in fact created negative economy there because their farmers had to compete with subsidized corn, had to remove to the cities, and their cities then got flooded, and people came north with undocumented immigration. So it created a whole series of problems, economic, at the bottom of both the United States and Canada. Detroit suffered from that. We're going to see that on steroids and magnified if the Trans-Pacific Partnership becomes law, because now we're talking about 12 countries so far, more can be added later, but countries like Vietnam, where the minimum wage is 35 cents an hour, or Peru, where it's $1.25 an hour, there's no way U.S. workers will compete with those. In fact, even China won't be able to compete with those kinds of wages. And so we're going to see a continued race to the bottom. And there was a study that came out by the Center for Economic and Policy Research just about 2 weeks ago that said two very important things. One, TPP would have almost no positive impact on our economy. The U.S. economy would grow by 0.1% a year. A new Apple phone does more than that. So it's almost insignificant. But secondly, it will continue the race to the bottom in wages. 90% of Americans, they said, would see their wages and income go down if the Trans-Pacific Partnership becomes law. So this will continue the same kind of problems. It will continue the high unemployment and the low wages that have plagued the United States now for many years.
This administration, like its predecessors, goes around shouting free trade, free trade, free trade, but none of us know what the terms of this treaty are.
That's right. He also talks about transparency and action secret, and this is not free trade. This is rigged trade. I think free trade is a marketing term, and what this really is rigged trade for the top transnational corporations, groups like Walmart and Monsanto and the big pharmaceuticals and big energy and the military-industrial complex. They're the ones who will profit from this rigged trade agreement. It's rigged for them in lots of different ways. You know, there have been 600 corporate advisors involved in this process from the beginning. They've been overseeing the process, and they've been changing the language of the TPP throughout. They've had lifetime access, so they can say, take those three words out, add these three words, take that section out, add this section. They can make changes. So the whole agreement, I'm sure, is filled with corporate tricks to help them. I'll just mention a couple of examples to give you a flavor of that we know about. One is the pharmaceutical stuff. This trade agreement is going to undermine the healthcare systems of Japan, Australia, New Zealand, some of the best healthcare systems in the world, because it will not allow them to negotiate pharmaceutical prices. It's going to continue the evergreening of patents so that prices will remain high, and it will not allow these countries to negotiate lower prices unless they include things like advertising and research and executive salaries as part of what that price is. So it really undermines those systems by making them much more expensive. It also just undermines those systems because state-supported enterprises, which is what single-payer is, are seen as an unfair trade practice, and that you have to level the playing field for the insurance industry. So that's going to be a big problem for those healthcare systems, and it'll be a big problem for Medicare in the United States as well. The other way they rig the system, and this is just two ways, there's many ways, but the other way is these trade tribunals. It allows for big corporations to sue for expected profits If the government passes a law that protects the environment, labor, consumers, safety, health care, and it costs the corporation money, they can sue in a trade tribunal for expected profits, the profits they thought they were going to get. And it goes to this trade tribunal, which has no review by legitimate courts, but just the trade tribunal is the final decision maker. Three judges, they come mainly from the corporations, their corporate lawyers on leave from their corporate job, making a decision and going back to their corporation. So it's an incredible rigging of the justice system, creating a new justice system that's parallel to a legitimate one that's controlled by the corporations. That's a rigged trade agreement. And that's why Obama's acting in secrecy. That's why he's pushing for fast track to keep Congress out, because there's no way this becomes law if people know what's in it.
In pushing for his trade policies, President Obama says that a way to bring jobs back to the United States is for foreigners to invest here, as if we are a developing country.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that, and I'm sure he does believe that, because there's, you know, now we've sent so much of our resources out of the country that there's a lot of money out there that I'm sure that we'd like to see brought back to the United States. But those foreign investors will have greater power than U.S. corporations under the TPP. They'll be able to sue the United States for our environmental laws, for our labor laws. They'll be able to sue the United States for Buy America provisions. They'll be able to sue the United States for green jobs and buy green provisions, buy local provisions. All those will be seen as unfair trade practices. So these foreign investors will come in and rob U.S. sovereignty at the federal, state, and local level, taking away the power of cities and states and the federal government to pass laws in the public interest. Otherwise, they go to these phony trade tribunals that are rigged for the corporations, and the cities, the states, and the feds pay millions of dollars in damages to the corporations for the profits that they expected they were going to get.
In other words, if the people of Detroit ever get their vote back and they elect politicians who decide that they're going to restructure Detroit so that Detroit buys products that Detroit makes, these foreign companies could sue Detroit.
Exactly. That's exactly how it would work. It would provide these foreign countries with more power than the local governments, than democratic governments at the state level, local level, and federal level. These governments could have the trump card of getting their profits no matter what public interest law is passed, and that law gets put on the backs of the citizens rather than the corporations that are doing the polluting, rather than the corporations that are cheating their workers, rather than the corporations that are not providing health care. Instead, it gets put in the back of the taxpayers, plus the corporations are guaranteed their profits because of these trade tribunal ripoffs.
And all of this, Obama wants to put on fast track to push it through Congress.
That's right. He basically wants to undermine the constitutional responsibility of Congress under the Commerce Clause. The Congress is responsible for negotiating trade with foreign governments, not the president. And he wants instead to put in place fast track, which would essentially cut Congress out of the picture. He would be allowed to negotiate the agreement. He'd be allowed to sign the agreement. And Congress would get a very limited amount of time to consider it. They only have 20 hours of debate, and then they have 60 days to vote yes or no. Senate would have 30 days, no real committee hearings, no real investigation. And this would probably be a multi-thousand-page agreement. So this is going to be complicated with these little words lines in there put in by the corporate lawyers who've been negotiating this, you know, for almost 4 years now. It's just amazing to me that Congress has the responsibility to negotiate trade. They don't even see this document. These corporations are overseeing the negotiation and telling the president how to negotiate trade. So the constitutional responsible party, Congress, has been cut out, and now Obama wants to cut them out even more with fast track and giving him all the power in this monarchy executive that we call a presidency.
The Bush administration was charged with allowing the energy industry to write administration energy policy. What we're seeing here is corporations being allowed to write international law.
That's right. Well, Obama is broader than just the oil industry. You know, there's no question the Bush administration is marinated in oil. But the Obama administration has big finance and he's helping, big agriculture like Monsanto and the whole GMO industry. He's helping the pesticide and herbicide industry of DuPont. He's helping the General Electric of the world who want to outsource their jobs, the Walmarts that want to lower wages. That's who he's helping. He's helping all these corporate interests, including big energy. He gets his flavor of marinated oil as well. but including big energy and big pharmaceuticals and all the insurance industry. Obama is across the board a corporatist. I can't think of a more corporatist administration that has a food czar from Monsanto and a job czar from the outsourcing General Electric and a financial team made up of Wall Streeters. And this TPP really is consistent with that kind of ideology of putting big corporate capital ahead of the people's interests and the interests of the planet.
So for the corporate world, the White House under Obama is a one-stop shop.
He covers them all, and he's doing it very generously. This will be a jet. If TPP passes, you can be sure that President Obama will get a lot of donations for the massive Obama Library and Visitor Center that I'm sure we'll see in the future.
Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance. Walmart, the biggest corporation in the world and the largest employer in the United States, didn't get that way by being nice to its workers. Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein of the University of California at Santa Barbara wrote an important book about Walmart. He says poverty is getting so bad in the United States, Walmart is facing stiff competition from even cheaper stores.
It is the dollar stores and the Dollar Tree, and these are these stores that are smaller, found in strip malls, and they serve the bottom of the working class. They're doing fine because people are so poor, and the merchandise is shoddy and cheap. Walmart, which is more kind of a solid part of the bottom of the working class, they're the ones who are hurt a lot. And just recently a report came out that sales were disappointing, and this is indicative of the squeeze. Gas prices, when the payroll taxes were restored on January 1st of 2013, that took a big chunk out of the disposable income of working-class Americans. So Walmart is a kind of bellwether for the status and well-being of the American working class.
Well, if Walmart is the bellwether, then the working class is doing pretty poorly. Huge proportions of Walmart's workers, which they call associates instead of employees,
right,
are not even full-time.
Right. I mean, yes, of course, Walmart is both the victim and the perpetrator of this problem. It's funny, Walmart would love to have the minimum wage raised for everybody in the country except those who work for Walmart. I wrote a book, one of the chapters was titled Walmart versus the World It Has Created. And so, yes, so for example, there are now three categories of workers at Walmart. There are kind of full-time hourly workers, okay, who make $11 an hour or something. There are part-time workers. And then they created a new category called temporary workers, who only be employed for 2 or 3 months. And that's a new category they created. So all of this is insecure, low wage, people can't plan their lives, and that's Walmart.
And it must create a nightmare for people who would try to organize into unions, Walmart employees.
Well, it does. And there has, we now have this organization called Air Walmart, which is sponsored in large part by the United Food and Commercial Workers. And they found a great deal of interest in various stores, but the turnover is enormous. And the fact is, union spark plugs, people who want to be, who can see the future, they want to improve conditions, they tend to be the more ambitious and more competent members of the working class. And so they're the ones who leave these jobs within a few months or years. It is difficult. And then, of course, the company itself is a master of anti-union activities and propaganda and things of that sort. And that's, they've got this down to a science and how you stop unions in any given store. That's sort of now well-known.
Isn't it part of Walmart's business plan to discourage effectively people from planning to have a career as a Walmart associate?
I think that's absolutely the case. Walmart, if you watch the TV commercials, they will always say, they've been saying this for 20 years now, that 75% of all store managers come out of the ranks. And that is absolutely true. That is true. However, if you look at it from the other point of view, what chance does an ordinary Walmart worker have to become a store manager? It's very, very small. It's much smaller, for example, than the chance of, say, an ordinary factory worker to become a foreman, or much less of a chance of, say, the ordinary clerk, you know, in some office to become the manager of that office. Because in a big box store with 300 workers or 400 workers, there are only about 7 or 8 salaried sort of managerial employees, which is a very few for the number of part-time. So yes, the Walmart employment model, and this is now spread throughout the economy, is low wage, temporary work, high turnover, and really no chance of advance in effect. Yes, there are always a few, and they'll point to them in their advertisements, but for the ordinary work, typical worker, there's very little chance. There's no job ladder. Everyone is making $9 to $13 an hour, and then maybe you get your chance, and then you become an assistant store manager making $45,000 or $50,000 a year, but that's very difficult.
But Walmart as a corporation has been quite successful in buying off through various ways political opposition from community groups, from local political leaders in those communities that it operates in or wants to set up shop in.
That's right. And whenever Walmart seeks to, you know, enter Chicago or Washington, D.C. or some big city, I mean, they go right away to the Latino or black organizations. They learned this from the tobacco companies 30 years ago. And so we have in Chicago and D.C., we see some small donations to local city groups. And really, it's kind of soft bribery. That's their modus operandi.
The bribery may be soft, but it seems quite effective.
I'm not an expert on the black community in, say, a city like Chicago, but from what I've seen, it created a sharp debate within these minority communities, Latino as well as black, and just the poor people. There's a sharp debate, and it's not that people just sort of right away fall over, oh, we're going to get another $310 an hour jobs, or, you know, we've gotten some money given to the school camp program. They understand what's going on. So I think it creates a debate. Very sharp, and certainly in Chicago it has been, on the question of Walmart entering the city.
Well, if the debate is about good jobs, then Walmart wouldn't even be part of the conversation.
Well, right. I mean, what they're really doing with Walmart is trading on the desperation of individuals and communities, which are really have been decimated by deindustrialization. And so, you know, the proponents will say, well, any job is better than none. And one of those, which I have investigated, and one of the Walmart calling cards, and this is certainly true in D.C. today, I think, and the west side of Chicago, is they say, well, look, there are all these food deserts, i.e. no grocery stores with fresh, you know, food. And so we're going to come in there, and we're going to have a good grocery store. And even Michelle Obama has been taken in a bit by this. Now, it turns out, if you look at where Walmart actually puts its stores, say in cities where it's been for 30 years, like Houston or Atlanta or Memphis, some big southern city, they've been there. Walmart does not put stores in the heart of the African-American ghetto. They don't put them there because the people don't have money to shop. You have food deserts where Walmart has been in the city for 30 years. So, yes, they'll put one store in some poor community as a way of kind of a loss leader, but this is not going to solve the problem. The problem of food deserts is created by people who don't have enough money to shop, and Walmart's not going to solve that problem because they need people to buy their products, and they're not going to get that with a desperately poor community.
And at the wages that Walmart pays, many of its employees need to shop at the dollar store.
Well, that's right. And actually, it turns out, I mean, people have studied this. When the stores first come in, there's always parades and balloons, and the company will, in its first wave of hiring, will hire a lot of people. They'll overstaff the store by about 50%, and they'll hire people from the local community. But in the next 2 years, they'll reduce the number of workers who are at the store to get down to their lean staffing level, which they want. And secondly, they will begin to hire, they'll tend to hire what they want, which is people who are looking for a job but have some skills and show up on time, you know. And so it's not going to be quite so much the community itself. People commute to Walmart stores from long distances, and the reason is that Walmart's hiring them. It's not that they can hire right within five blocks of the store if they wanted to, but they choose not to do that because they aren't always the people they want.
And studies have shown that when Walmart comes into a section of town, there results a net loss of jobs.
It's a wash, but the jobs that end up are these Walmart jobs. And again, they set the wage level for everything. And one of the good things, by the way, recently about the fast food rising, the protest in New York for fast food workers, and then the Walmart protest as well, it's not a question of Walmart as one company or Target as one company, which is particularly bad. They're all bad. Walmart is the biggest, so it's the baddest. But it's a question of raising the wage level in general for the entire service economy. And that's what has to happen. I mean, $15 an hour, McDonald's, Burger Flipper, and $18 an hour Walmart stockers. It can be done. Costco, a very successful, very large discount company that pays much better wages, has careers, better benefits, and much, much less turnover. So it can be done, and I think that's the road forward here.
In fact, Costco pays its average worker $21.96 an hour.
And the company's very successful. So I think what we really need to do is raise the general wage level of the entire service economy, which retail, hotels, restaurants, and we're talking about 50, 60, 70 million people here. So this is what needs to be done. I think it will be done through some combination of agitation at the stores and restaurants themselves, and then raising the wages, the minimum wage going up. I think Obamacare will, in fact, over time, have an impact in actually raising the real wage, the real social wage, anyway, of people who work in this economy. So it can be done. I think there's a path forward.
Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein is author of the book, The Retail Revolution, How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. Dr. Johnny Williams is a professor of sociology at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Trinity is part of what is sometimes called the Little Ivy League. Dr. Williams says too many students really believe that Americans are an exceptional people, different from every other nation in the world, and that U.S. society is superior to all others on the planet. This, says Dr. Williams, is a very dangerous worldview.
One that will lead, ultimately, if it is not corrected, to devastation of the planet. This is really a white Euro-American kind of experience, one of privilege, one of exceptionalism, and so forth. There's no doubt about it that there are many black and Latino Asian folks who are sleepwalking and have bought into the hegemony of exceptionalism. All we got to do is witness the fact that we still got a hardcore 40% of black Americans who are supporting Obama, no matter what he does, even though that 40% before was totally against war if Obama wasn't in office. In 2003, they weren't for the war, but now they are. So how to overcome that is the key. And the only way that I know that one can overcome this kind of destructive direction in which we're headed in is this. These are the facts. They're cutting education. They're cutting supplemental nutrition assistance program, SNAP. They're cutting everything, but they're investing in destruction. And this requires students to think that this kind of way of being, this kind of economy, this economy of militarism and destroying things is the best way to go. And that there'll be no repercussion for them destroying other people around the world, that there's no kind of blowback to them. But we know that's not true. We know that's not true because we can look at the blowback that occurred after Somalia when Clinton went in and then Bush came into office, and we see El-Shabaab now going into the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, killing people because of the surrogates of the United States going in to do things to Somalians. But the fact is that people don't know that. They're not informed about that. Most of my students, they don't even know what El-Shabaab is. They don't even know what Somalia is. So they couldn't tell you what Kenya is. Teachers are being downsized. Even in my profession, there's 1.5 million of us in the PhD profession in the United States. Only 500 million of those are employed in tenured positions. The rest of them are adjuncts making $2,000 per class. That's nothing. I mean, it's basically poverty wages. For a PhD, that becomes even problematic.
This raises questions about the whole trend in education in the United States with this emphasis on engineering and mathematics and the downplaying of knowledge about the kind of world that we live in.
It also applies to a big segment of the economic elite who can't think outside the box that they're in, this individualistic profit-making box. Everything is about a profit. Nothing can be excluded from that. Everything has to be directed towards making a profit, even if it kills you. But that's the orientation of our society, and that's the dominant kind of ideological orientation that we have that reigns supreme in our society. So what can we do to combat that? Well, people like me who are there, but intellectuals have traditionally been more in line with the dominant way of doing things because of our own kind of insecurity and of secretiveness when it comes to power itself. I mean, we're more compliant than anybody else. We tell the story in a way in which the economic elite want us to tell the story about the world, right? So most of the PhDs around the world are not really into questioning the world. They're into letting it go along the way it is through its logical kind of destruction, if you will, because of the kind of mentality that people have. This is the same thing that goes for teachers. Now, there are many teachers, though a critical mass of them, who are not like this. And they're questioning, and they're giving pushback. So you see this all around the world. You see this in North America. They moved this privatization scheme to Mexico now. Well, the Mexican teachers are in the streets protesting this idea to try to dumb them down and to deunionize them and so forth, the same way that's being done by Ari Duncan and President Obama through their failed program, Race to the Top. But they're working on all different realms and levels. NSA isn't really just about buying on us. It's really about trying to control us, too. If we know what you're thinking, then we can know how to manipulate you to do what we want you to do. So it's a big picture kind of thing. So you got to attack it on multiple levels. And one way to do it is to say we're not going to participate in this privatization scheme of public education. We're not going to participate in standardization testing and so forth because that stuff doesn't work. It proves nothing. Everybody in the higher education know that ACT and SAT is predictive basically nothing. Basically predict how well you're doing college maybe for one semester. That's about it. It's a big scheme of making money. Everything's about profit making, not about the advancement of humanity. It's about advancement for the wealthy few, the top 0.01%, basically. It's about them. It's not about anybody else. Everybody else is a pawn in their game.
All of this would be bad enough if the United States were Switzerland, but it's a superpower which has the capacity to destroy the world.
Exactly. And when a critical mass of people arose, say, first in Wisconsin, then in Michigan, and then when Occupy arose, it scared the living daylights out of the powerful people in the United States, the Wall Street crowd, the economic elite in the United States, the government. It scared them because for the first time they realized that in any society, hegemony only means there's a predominance of control. Dissent never disappears. It's always there. And so they knew that they had to crack down and crack down not peacefully. They had to be violent about it because these movements was counter to what it is that they were saying ideologically and that there was another way, an alternative way of being. And as a result, then they cracked down violently. So they see it as a tremendous threat. But they're actually sowing the seeds of their own destruction by their continuing wanting to exploit people. And people are waking up from their sleep. Black America, for the first time since Obama was elected, started to wake up after the Trayvon Martin incident occurred with Zimmerman. And we're still trying to wake up and start doing what we traditionally have done to guide this country in the right way it needs to go for humanity, not just for a few people.
Professor Johnny Williams of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Over the last 6 months, 97% of the net increase in American jobs has been in part-time employment. Dr. Richard Wolff is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He says the bosses prefer that their workers be poor and insecure.
The worker doesn't expect benefits to be available at all, or at least if any, at a much lower level than a full-time job. So an employer would rather have, to be simple about it, two part-time workers that he doesn't have to pay benefits to doing half-time work rather than one full-time worker who would have to be paid and then benefits would have to be provided. That's an old and long-standing arrangement. There is speculation that the new medical care law, because of the way it's written, does give an incentive to employers to hire part-time because that way they can escape some of the provisions of that law. But I think the more profound reason that this is happening is because of things that are producing not only a surge of part-time work, but also, and just as significant, a pattern in which the jobs that were lost in this crisis, the millions of jobs that were lost, many of which were full-time jobs, were well-paid jobs, jobs with lots of benefits and lots of security, have been replaced, if at all. And remember, we're not even halfway back to where the unemployment was before this crisis hit. But for those who are getting jobs, they're discovering that the job they lost was much, much better than the job they can find, if they're lucky enough to find one, because it's either part-time, or it's much lower paid, or it's much less benefited, or it's much less security. And most of these jobs are much less across the board on all those things. And so we're seeing that not only is the unemployment still with us, but even those who have managed to get a job are discovering that they're earning much less, have many fewer benefits, and are much less secure. That's the profound shift that's going on.
Yes, when we talk about employment security, today I think it's a different kind of insecurity. In the past, employment security meant whether you had a job or not. But insecurity seems to be built into the workplace these days.
That's right. It's more and more shaky. You know, the Europeans have coined a new term. Instead of calling the working class the proletariat, in Europe, the term has become the precariat. In other words, to drive home the point you just made, namely that almost all jobs now are stripped of whatever tenure or security or solidity they once had. Workers are being told, if they even need to be, that their job is at the mercy of their employer, that if they don't perform at whatever level the employer says, they will be fired. Workers understand that there are loads of folks out there, many in their neighborhoods, in their families, desperate for work at a time when unemployment is this high. So you have all the conditions for whatever workers were able to gain in the past by strikes, by struggles, by negotiations, is being steadily and pretty quickly taken away.
Precariat, as in every worker's job is precarious. That is a crisis for people who are working or need work, but it sounds like employer heaven.
Absolutely. It's been employer heaven in the United States for the last 30 years. Real wages, if that is the way we measure this, the wage a worker gets when you adjust it for the prices he or she has to pay, and so you get a real sense of what the wage enables you to afford. The real wage today in 2013 is about what it was in 1978. You've had no real increase in wages, but meanwhile, over all those last 30 to 40 years, the productivity of workers, the amount of goods and services an average American worker produces per hour, has gone steadily up. Well, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to understand that if the productivity of the worker keeps going up, that represents that much more that the worker produces for his employer to sell. But if at the same time the employer is not increasing the real wage, then we have the worker giving more and more to the employer, while the employer doesn't have to give any more to the worker. And so, of course, for 30 or 40 years, we can see the exploding stock market and we can see the growing gap between those who get what the worker produces, the employing class, versus the working class. And that's the inequality that's on everybody's lips and confronting us literally every day.
Back in the day when we heard that the stock market was up, that was an indication, or taken as one, that the economy was booming. But stock markets being up don't necessarily mean good news for people on the bottom.
Absolutely. I mean, think of it this way. Capitalism was born, most people agree, about 300 years ago as a dominant economic system in Great Britain, England. And it spread from there to Western Europe, North America, and basically eventually to Japan as well. And that's where the first 200 or 300 years of capitalism developed. And it was prosperous, and they made a lot of money, these capitalists, and they plowed it back into their businesses. And they had tremendous fights with their workers over the very conditions you and I have just been discussing, wages, benefits, security, all of that. And slowly, because the workers fought, they were able to raise, at least for many workers, not all, but for many, standards of living, rates of wages. So fast forward to the 1970s, and you have a situation where the wages and standard of living of people in North America, Western Europe, and Japan are much, much higher than what they are in Asia, Africa, Latin America, etc. And the 1970s is the key moment, because at that point, businesses, capitalists around the world decided that they no longer wanted to pay the high wages that they had been paying to their workers in North America, Western Europe, and Japan. Modern jet engines made travel around the world easy and quick, and the modern telecommunications, the internet, email, and all of that made it possible for a capitalist in New York to control and monitor a factory in China just as easily as he could control and monitor a factory 10 miles away. And so the capitalists decided, and they really did, and it's obvious, that they could make tremendous new profits basically by leaving Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and moving production to India, China, Brazil, Nigeria, wherever. And they've been doing that for 30 or 40 years, basically hollowing out and leaving. And this has meant enormous profits for them because, I mean, just to give you an example, there was a demonstration 2.5 weeks ago in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh in Asia. And 200,000 workers were marching through the streets. Made you think of a British or German history 200 years ago. They were marching through the streets demanding a higher minimum wage. Here was their demand. They wanted a wage of $100 per month because their current minimum wage is $38 per month. Well, it doesn't take anyone more than 2 seconds to understand the attraction for moving an automobile company out of Detroit, for example, a factory, close it in Detroit, and open it in Bangladesh or a dozen other such countries, because you're going to be able to get pretty much the same work using the same machines, monitored by the same electronic mechanisms. And the difference is you don't have to pay your workers next to nothing compared to what you'd have to pay an auto worker in Detroit. And that's why, just to stay with the example, Detroit is in bankruptcy. It's a city that has declined from a population just under 2 million back in the 1960s to a population today of under 700,000. I mean, Detroit is the future of North America, Western Europe, and Japan. And along with that go the collapse of the quality of jobs, the security of jobs, the income of jobs. That's why people have to understand that while the current crisis is indeed a terrible experience for millions of Americans, crises are by their definition relatively short-term phenomena. What we have just as serious is a long-term decision by capitalists to move to where profits take them, and that means kissing goodbye, and I don't mean kissing in a nice way, kissing goodbye Western Europe and North America and plunging these parts of the world into the kind of decline that those parts of the world imagined they were immune to but are now discovering that they weren't.
And now, specifically in Detroit, we not only see a decline of jobs, but also the absence of even the basic bourgeois democratic trappings, such as the right to elect your own officials.
Give you an example. Automobile company like General Motors is not only abandoning Detroit and basically much of the United States, but as General Motors finds itself producing more cars in China than it does in the United States, that's where it wants to pay taxes. That's where it wants those workers to get a decent education, because that's where General Motors thinks its future is. So they're not going to be willing to pay taxes, not to save Detroit, not to save Louisville, not to save anywhere else that they're located, because their whole focus is somewhere else. Now, if you're a rich American, if you're one of the 1% of American shareholders that own 70% of the stocks, well, you're going to participate in General Motors' great good luck. You're going to smile. You're going to be cashing in on these profits. But if you're one of the masses of Americans who depends directly or indirectly through your family on a job with these employers, you're not going to be smiling at all. That's why we have an economy now that where we talk on the media of a recovery, but we're really only talking about the top 2, 3, 4% of the American people. They're recovered because they're cashing in on the rising profits that come from exploiting workers at lower wages outside the United States compared to paying decent wages here. And so the recovery for them is real, but the recovery for the other 97% of the American people is only something you read about in the newspapers, because it's not built into your situation, neither in this crisis nor in the longer run, given that we permit capitalist enterprises, based on looking for what's good for them, to leave the United States at will, move to a place where they can pay workers much, much less, make a ton of profits, and here comes the big thing, have absolutely no responsibility for the social disaster that their decisions impose. And they are Detroit or Cleveland or Camden, New Jersey, or the town I was born in, Youngstown, Ohio. These are all the walking dead cities of America that are haunting us because they are the future if the people of this country do not prevent capitalists from having the freedom to make more money and to put all the expenses of what they are doing, push them off onto the population as a whole.
And to hear the corporate media tell it, Apple is the American success story, but Apple only added 400 jobs in the United States last year. It's really a Chinese company.
Absolutely. Apple is at the cutting edge. That's why they're so successful. That's why they're so big. They didn't build up in the United States and then move. They made the decision, partly because they're a relatively young company, never to commit to the United States at all, to take advantage and get a competitive edge by being among the first to leave, in the sense of building their capacity, their factories, their deals, all over the rest of the world. And you can see it in a dozen other, McDonald's hamburger joint is now getting more of its profits out of the country than in. Pepsi-Cola has been doing that for a long time. And the list goes on and on and on. For them, as they say in seminars that I sometimes attend, the United States, they refer to as a quote-unquote mature economy. Watch out for that word. Hold on to your wallet. What mature means is that that isn't growing very quickly anymore, whereas the rest of the world, where they're precisely moving all their production, is growing. So that's not only where they want to produce, but that's where they want to spend their advertising dollars. That's where they want to do promotion. That's where they are willing to pay taxes, to have a good relationship with the local political authorities. And all that money, built on the backs of Western Europe, North America, and Japan, is taken by these capitalists to make more money elsewhere in the world. You know, the irony, if I can say this, the irony is that for the last 200 to 300 years, capitalism as a system made a deal, and I'll talk here just about the United States. It made a deal with the United States. Okay, we get the lion's share of all the profits. We become richer and richer. We become more and more powerful to control politics, to control access to culture and all the rest. But we'll give you, the working class, something. We'll give you rising wages and a rising standard of living. They did that for most of the 19th century and really for the 20th as well, up to about the 1970s. The new world that we inhabit, you, I, and everybody else listening, is a world of capitalism that has decided to move on, to abandon the United States, Western Europe, and Japan, and to go to where, for them, profit-wise, the grass is greener. And therefore, they offer to the American working class a new deal, if you like. No more rising wages, no more rising standard of living. In fact, your children are going to live less well than you, and your grandchildren less well than that. And the real political dynamite question of our time is, will the working classes of Europe, America, and Japan be willing to tolerate and accept a capitalism when it offers them declining wages the way they were when the system offered at least the bulk of them rising wages? Until that question is answered, no one knows what's about to happen.
And so when President Obama says that these good jobs, many of them, are not coming back, he's basically saying the deal is off, get used to it.
Exactly. And that's been his job. I believe it was neither an accident nor, not to take away from his skills, but not much about those skills. I think this system, the people who run it, understood what I just said over the last 5 minutes real well, and they know this is going to be a tough time for capitalists not to provoke in the working class exactly what you might think happens. And so it becomes very important that Democrats rather than Republicans, liberals rather than conservatives, and in this case an African American rather than a white person, to lead the process for them, because they're less likely to get the kickback as soon as might have happened if a John McCain were trying and leading the country to stick it to the working class rather than a Barack Obama. I don't mean to be cynical, but I think it is naive not to understand that those whose job it is to keep the lid on politically in this society are not oblivious to how best to do that. I'll give you one more illustration. The city in the United States that is actually doing something even worse than Mr. Orr in Detroit is the city of San Jose, California, the third largest city in California, where not only do they have a Democratic mayor who is basically savaging the pensions, both of current workers and of future employees for the city of San Jose, but he proudly says in his statements that he is a Democrat and that what he's doing is necessary, could not be successfully done because of its controversial quality if it were a Republican. So he proudly takes on himself as a Democrat the job of leading the working class into a resigned acceptance to a long-term decline. I mean, he doesn't use those last words, but if you read what he says, that's what it amounts to, and that's what that wing of the Democratic Party seems to be willing to do if the deal involves keeping them in political power and keeping their patrons happy. Then the rest of us should march into our own decline without a murmur.
And that is the meaning of New Democrats, just as in Britain, New Labour.
Exactly. It's the folks who are, to use an even older phrase, the labor lieutenants of capital, the folks who do the work of the capitalist within the ranks of the workers, who get their rewards for doing that, but who are the folks who will preach that there is no alternative to all of this, that this is somehow built into either the stars or technology or God's will or whatever other rationale they can think of to get the mass of working people to go along. And let me stress that last point. If the mass of working people say no, we're not going to do this. You are not going to leave our cities unless you either pay enormous amounts of money to us to compensate us for all we have done over 50 or 100 years of your company's growth to help you grow, to subsidize your parking lot, to give you a break in taxes, to help students learn the techniques you need to have in your workers. The unlimited number of ways that the public has financed, subsidized, and helped every capitalist grow. You're not going to take all of that and move to China and leave us with no jobs, with no incomes, with no taxes coming to our cities and states, unable not only to have work, but unable to provide the social services that a civilized society requires. You're not doing that. And if you think you are, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take the factory the minute you empty it, and we are going to work with the workers you've abandoned. And we're going to convert those enterprises into cooperative enterprises, and we're going to run around the United States telling the American people, you've got a choice. You can buy the product you've always bought, now being produced in India or China, by a company that abandoned its community and abandoned its workers, or you can pay us, who are continuing to produce in the same factory with Americans and their communities intact. You confront American capitalists with that risk, and they're going to rethink what they're doing. And even if they don't, it gives you a real strategy for coping. The city of Detroit would be a completely different place if such a strategy had been pursued over the last 30 years, rather than one failed, limp, inadequate, quote-unquote, reconstruction program after another, none of which were properly financed and none of which were grounded in the kind of a jobs program without which none of this will work.
Dr. Richard Wolff is currently a visiting professor at the New School in New York. In 1972, Herman Wallace and two other Black Panther Party inmates at Louisiana's notorious Angola State Prison were charged with killing a prison guard. Wallace and Albert Woodfox spent the next 41 years in solitary confinement. Last week, a federal judge ordered a new trial for Wallace and set him free. Less than 3 days later, Herman Wallace died of liver cancer. He would have been 72 this week. Back in 2005, the good people at Prison Radio conducted this interview with Wallace.
I wonder why everybody think I'm a poet. I'm not a poet. And understand something. I did this, and it wasn't meant to be a poem. It was meant to be a statement. I was in a dungeon at the time when I wrote it. And I just decided to write something about myself and the things, the changes that I was going through and how I got where I am. Somebody said it was a poem. I said, you got to be kidding me. It's a statement. Then when I got locked up for it and all of this, it just took off. They removed my whisper from general population to maximum security. I gain a voice. They remove my voice from maximum security to administrative segregation. My voice gave hope. They remove my voice from administrative segregation to solitary confinement. My voice became vibration for unity. They remove my voice from solitary confinement to the supermax of Camp J. And now, they wish to destroy me. The louder my voice, the deeper they bury me. I said, the louder my voice, the deeper they bury me. Free all political prisoners, prisoners of war, prisoners of consciousness. Herman Wallace, Angle 3. The title of this poem is A Defiant Voice. If death is the realm of freedom, then through death I escape to freedom, which is a quote by Fran Fanon.
Your conditions lawsuit originated with the censorship of a book that you were getting. Tell me about that.
It started off with Live from Death Row, one of Mumia's books. This took place back in 1999 or 2000 when they recognized the affiliation that I had with Mumia. But understand something, this book here is in the prison library. But any time that I would take and send for books of this nature here, any of Mumia's books, they won't allow me to have none of them. They tell me I can't have them, it's a threat to the institution. Anything that's on a political level, they say that it's a threat to security when it comes to me. We have a lawsuit pending right now, which could and would affect prisons around the country as far as long-term confinements and stuff of this nature here. Keeping men locked up for 20 and 30 years, that is cruel and unusual punishment. And that's one of the things that we're trying to prove right now. And since it's a federal case, it would affect other prisons around the country as well.
Tell me about your conditions. You've been held in solitary now for a very long time. How long? And tell me about closed cell restriction.
Yes, I've been held in a cell, a one-man cell, a single cell without any contact with anyone else for the past 32 years and 9 months. The conditions in these cells, you are denied some of the basics that a human being should have. You are denied human contact. You are denied being able to get a proper education. So when you look at it from that perspective, you're seeing where you are denied due process under the 14th Amendment, inalienable rights that you are supposed to have, and that is one of the cruelest part about this. Being written up is not basically anything that an inmate would have to do. If security wants you in a dungeon, if they want to come after you for some reason, some personal reason, some vendetta or something to that nature here, They can come in the cell right now, and for anything, they can write me up for it. I mean, they can write me up for having too many damn letters in the cell, all right? So, but the procedure is that they allow us to have all of these things. And just like recently, I was written up for a pair of earrings that I had got for a friend. It's not a write-up. It's not anything that can be considered a threat to security, which would be contraband. What would be contraband is the tools that's required in order to make the earrings. So they written me up for the earrings, and they also written me up for the very poem that I just now cited to you and said that both were contraband. But for some reason or another, through my struggle and appealing and fighting back with it, they rerouted me, and they just dropped everything and brought me back to the cell.
What are the kinds of things that you could be written up?
I have a disciplinary report that said I had a toothbrush with a piece of string on it that was fashioned in order to open my window. We do open the windows. You know, you can get a crank from security in order to open the window. I was a bit ingenious about this, and I used the string and put it on a toothbrush. Now, they give us the strings. They give us the toothbrushes. But I just put the string on the damn toothbrush in order to turn the damn window and open it. And they said that it was against the rules. I had a candy bar and a pack of chewing gum, and they wrote me up for that. Oh, yeah, and I had 36 pictures. Those are little minor things.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, make arrangements to attend our 7th anniversary celebration and fundraiser at New York's historic Riverside Church on Friday, October 18th. Last year's event was fantastic, and we guarantee that this year will be even better. So go to the Black Agenda Report site and sign up now for the October 18th celebration. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.